นมัตตุรัตนตยัสสะ So today we're live here from Los Angeles, broadcasting on the internet and broadcasting in virtual reality as well. And today I'll be talking about meditation. As I promised, today we'll be more focused on the meditation practice. And there's a lot of difference of opinion on the value of meditation, not to mention the nature of meditation that is considered to be valuable. So on the one hand, we have a wide variety of different ideas of what is proper meditation. And as well, we have a lot of people who simply don't see the benefit of meditation at all. And today, I guess I'd like to start looking at sort of why and how and what the result is of these views that meditation is not really of any use or any value. So you have people saying that, life is not that bad. Really, there's no reason that they can think of that they should practice meditation. They think, maybe life isn't perfect, but I can't see any benefit to purifying the mind or clearing the mind or whatever other good things might come from meditation. And when they hear about things like nirvana, they even can shy away and say, "Oh, that's certainly not something that I want." If there is such a thing as to be reborn again, then I'm more than happy to come back again. I think that's what I would prefer for instance. Or people who believe that there is no rebirth, so when you die, that's it, and so there's no reason for them to consider to purify their mind. They can soil their mind as much as they like, and as long as they are able to chase after all the pleasures that they wish, then that's okay, because when they die, that's it, and there's no tallying up, and there's no consequences of one's actions. So this latter view, which sort of holds in the modern world quite perniciously, is probably the scariest of them all. And it's scary because the implications are pretty profound. That if one were to take this to its extreme, as the Lord Buddha said, then there's no reason why we shouldn't just kill and steal and lie and cheat and do whatever we want to get ahead. And we see this as, to at least some extent, what happens in the world. Whereas there might be moralists who try to find reason to have morality without thinking about the consequences or the broad-reaching consequences, but simply sort of out of a gut feeling that we might have, or a collective consciousness even. So they have all these actually pretty weird ideas that they can come up with, like the idea of a collective sense of compassion for each other, or this idea of what's right or what we think to be right that is right and so on. But we still see in the world that most people who would hold to this view don't have any serious interest in morality, and they're willing to do and to say and to act in ways that are unethical. And so we see in the world, in the consumer societies, capitalist societies where people are fighting against each other and competing and lying and cheating and doing anything to get ahead because they have no concept of the repercussions of their actions. And then we have people who seem to be contradicting themselves. They do act in moral ways, but moral and ethical ways, but they can't seem to find any logical basis for it. Other than that, it doesn't feel right to do and to say bad things. It just doesn't feel right. And so they can often go by this and say, "Well, I just wouldn't do those things. I don't think it's a good thing to do." And I guess that's fine if you're an inherently moral person, but this obviously doesn't work on a broad scale. If we were to just hold that as our idea of what is right and wrong, well, whatever I think is right, whatever I think is wrong, it would have scary ramifications for those people who were unable to tell the difference innately between right and wrong, and there's obviously quite a few of those, quite a number of people like this. A great percentage of the people in the world are unable to tell the difference between right and wrong, and so do and say and think bad things just as second nature. In fact, most of us do, though we might think of ourselves as moral beings, due to our lack of mental training and meditation practice, we're simply unable to see when we do and say and think bad things. We don't notice it. We don't notice when we say things that hurt other people, and we forget it quite quickly. We're really good at forgetting painful situations and only remembering good ones and always striving after good and pleasant sensations. And so in general we have all these different this range of views, and these are the ones I've been talking about are the ones where people would then say, "No, I don't see any reason to meditate. I don't see any reason to practice mental development or training myself." And what we see in general is that only those people who really meet with extreme suffering are at all interested in meditation. And this is an interesting observation because the truth is really this kind of extreme suffering could come to any of us, but it won't come to all of us. Some of us will simply not experience this extreme suffering, which leads so many people to take up meditation. And yet, those who do seem to take up meditation quite easily, understand it, understand the need for it, and get really incredible results, and can actually become very good meditation teachers and are able to then become noble and really pure and amazing people. Of much more so than say someone who is, sort of got it good in life. And so some people come to think that, well, meditation is maybe only for those people who suffer a lot, those people who have chemical imbalances or whatever you want to call the causes for all of these causes for mental suffering. And this really isn't the case, but it's just that we're most of us are so confused and so befuddled in the world that it takes something extreme like that to really wake us up. The Buddha said it's like different kinds of horses. There are a select few horses out there that you don't have to hit them with a stick. You just have to show them the stick. You pick up a stick, the stick that they hit the horse with, and show it to them. And simply showing the stick to the horse is enough to make it say, "Okay, now I know what I have to do." But other horses, you have to hit them with a stick. You just touch them with it. Other horses, you have to hit them till it hurts. And some horses, you have to hit them so hard that you leave a bruise before they really get the point, get the message. Then there are even more horse. There are many more horses, or there are some horses, I suppose, that no matter how hard you hit them, they'll never learn. They'll never understand what it is that they should be doing, and they'll never be able to listen to their masters. And the Buddha said, people are like this as well. Some people, they may not experience pain, but they just hear about somebody. They hear about someone else. Oh, someone getting old, someone getting sick, someone getting meeting with suffering in this way or that way. And they don't even know the person, but that's enough for them to say, wow, that could come to me as well. And then they take up the practice. Like, it's a shock for them. They're so keenly trained. Their mind is so clear that they're able to take that as enough of an impetus to practice meditation. They see for themselves. They say, oh, wow, my mind is not ready for such a thing. If that comes to me, I'll be in great danger and great suffering. And so they start practicing. And of course, other humans, it has to come to someone they know. They have to maybe see with their own eyes, see someone getting sick or old or dying, and maybe not someone who's related to them, but someone that they see. Someone they get to see someone suffering terribly, and that's enough of an impetus for them to say, "Oh, that could come to me." And this life of us of ours is has so much potential for suffering, and really. Even our everyday normal everyday life has great suffering in it from time to time. It's just that we're not clear-minded enough to see that we're in this incredible state of suffering. We're like a pig living in filth, that we've gotten so accustomed to it that we don't realize that it's an incredible state of suffering. And so when we see this and we realize this in the extreme form, what we're really dealing with on a day-to-day basis, and then we start to practice meditation. You see, if you've never practiced meditation, it has to be some extreme. This is the point, is because we're in general so clouded in our minds, it has to be something so extreme before we actually decide that it's time to take up meditation practice. For some people, it has to come to a loved one when your father or your mother or someone close to you meets with great suffering or passes away. And you can see them suffering, crying, in great pain and suffering, as an incredible number of people in this world have to face every day. Then they realize, and we can see that all of these people who had to face this great suffering, the great majority of them are not ready for it and fall into great mental suffering as a result of the external difficulties. Whereas we could say that maybe it's just an external difficulty or problem. We then go ahead and turn it into an internal or a mental problem as well. And when we see people like this, even though it hasn't come to us yet, we realize that, you know, this is the way we are as well. And if this suffering comes to us, we wouldn't be able to fare any better than they would. And so we train our minds, and as you train your minds, it's not only the extreme states of suffering that become clear. All forms of suffering become incredibly clear to you, and you start to realize that there's so much suffering in our daily lives that we could really do without. We could really live without. And if we were to just spend some time training our minds, we could be without. We could be free from. We're actually living in a very pitiful state most of the time, most people. We're always chasing after good things, running away from bad things, giving rise to all sorts of unwholesome states of mind. In Buddhism, there are a total of 16. They're called the upakilesa, and these are the bad states that come about in our mind. It's like the detailed explanation of what's going on in our mind, and these are the bad things that we give rise to when we're not mindful, and these are the things that give rise to suffering. This is why when we experience things, we're not We're not able to just see things as they are, but instead we like them and don't like them, and we give rise to anger and greed and all sorts of jealousy and so on. And we cause suffering for other people and suffering for ourselves. The 16 are Abhichavisamalobha, is the first one, which is great or intense greed. This Abhichavisamalobha, or it just means greed, I guess, wanting a lot, or having great wanting, or having greed, having desire. This is the big one. If we didn't desire things, then when we got bad things or other things or things that we didn't want, we wouldn't ever be upset. When this is the thing that we notice about wanting, about craving, is that it sets up expectations in our mind that things should be in that way, that that's the way it should be. And when it's not that way, we become disappointed, we become angry. And that's the second one, is Pyabada, which is ill will or wishing harm to other people or to animals or to even inanimate objects. We can be angry at them. And anger, number three. Number four is vengeance, seeking vengeance against other people. Upanaha. And all of these ones come because of the greed, because of the attachment that we have for things. We have attachment to sensations, we have attachment to experience, we have attachment to people. We want people to be this way or that way, and when they're not, then we get angry at them. We get upset with them. We want people to be exactly the way. When people get married or in relationships, they're so sweet to each other. Most relationships are like this. When we have friendships as well, they always start off sweet, and then, because this is the way we work as human beings, we're very nice to people who we don't know well. It's kind of a courtesy sort of gut reaction where we're very courteous to people that we don't know, and as we get to know them better and better, then we start to treat them more and more familiar until you see how husbands and wives treat each other. They treat each other, it almost looks like animals, like inhuman. It gets to the point where it can be totally impolite and bossy and so on. The number five one is makkha, which is ingratitude. So we have all this taking advantage of each other because of our inability to see things clearly, to understand the nature of things. Then we give rise to ingratitude towards people who have helped us, ingratitude towards our parents, ingratitude towards our friends and people who have done good things for us, and so on. You see, as I was talking about this morning in morning chanting, all of these things are not only evil, they're actual perversions of reality. They're out of line with reality. And the funny thing about the universe, this sort of really amazing quality of reality, is that goodness is in line with reality. The more you understand reality, the less likely you are to do evil things. Your clear understanding is synonymous with goodness. Goodness and reality are synonymous, whereas evil is totally out of whack with reality. Because we do these things thinking that it's going to bring us some benefit or some positive result. And it doesn't. It doesn't do that. It brings suffering for other people and brings suffering to ourselves. We don't have to talk about next lives. People often look at Buddhism or meditation and say, well, I don't see the point of that, and I don't believe in karma and so on. And it's kind of funny to hear that because there's nothing to believe about karma. That it's a part of nature. It's a part of reality. Every time you do a bad deed, it's a perversion of reality. It's due to misunderstanding of the nature of things. It's synonymous with illusion or it's the opposite of that which is real. It comes from not seeing things the way they are. It's like untruth, it's falsehood. So when people have done good things for us, then being in gratitude, this is a it's out of whack with the way we should be behaving. We can see people who have done great things for others. And there's the story of the Bodhisattva when he was a monkey, or an ape, I guess. And there was this man who had fallen into a pit. And the monkey was very kind. I mean, this was the Bodhisattva. And so he pulled the man out of the pit. And when he got the man out of the pit, the man was. The man looked at the monkey and he thought, "Oh, this is a big monkey. Looks like a it would be a good thing to eat." And he got hungry because he was off hunting in the forest. And so instead of being thankful to the monkey for pulling him out of the pit, he picked up a stick and whacked the monkey over the head. And the monkey was half dead, and he picked the monkey up and put the monkey on his back and started off out of the forest. And rather than, thanking the monkey and praising him and being in awe of the kind nature of even wild animals, he went the opposite and took advantage of the situation and beat the monkey almost to death. And the monkey was lying on his back, and the man's walking out of the forest. And he realizes that he's getting lost in the forest. So as he's walking out of the forest, looking around, and he can't find his way back, the monkey realizes he's lost, and the monkey says to him, "You have to turn left now, and this is the way out," and helping him to find the way out. And the Brahmin, the man, as a result of the monkey's kindness, became just suddenly it just hit him that this monkey was, what was he doing, killing this monkey, thinking that it was food, when this monkey had such an opposite nature, and the monkey was actually only looking out for his own benefit, for the man's benefit. It's like not seeing things as they are, and we can see that the opposite is true when people are meditating and so on. They become very grateful to people. Meditators often come to think of their parents when they practice and so on. Think of people who have helped them. The next one is balasa, which is comparison, comparing ourselves to other people. And we see this in modern society. People are often guilty of this defilement of thinking that everyone's equal. And so not putting other people up higher than us. We don't like to ever put anyone up higher than us. We like to think that we're all born equal, right? This is what we've sort of grown out of, this aristocracy idea, or this idea of being born in a higher class or something like that. But that's not what's meant here. The thing that we throw out with all of that is we throw out the idea that there might be someone who has gone farther than us, or there might be someone who is worth honoring or worth revering, like for instance the Buddha. And so people are always when people modern people from the West, or people living in a atheist society or so on, or a society that is non-religious, or people who have never been religious before, come to Buddhism, they're often even to the point of being disrespectful towards the Buddha, or disrespectful towards their teacher, or disrespectful towards monastics or so on. I've had meditators come and, yell at me. Say, I even had a meditator once throw some candy at me. It was quite a. It's been a lot of fun dealing with Western people, and I mean, it's something that you take in stride, but it's something that we have to understand. We have to kind of be wary of this, that in as in all cases, that we don't take things for granted that they're as being true. We take it for granted that we're all equal, and we don't like this idea of holding someone higher than us. And in Buddhism, holding someone higher than you can be a great tool. It helps you curb your own ego. I'm saying this is my teacher, and even if they make me angry, I'm going to let go of it. I'm going to still hold on to them as my teacher, and so on. Looking up to our parents and saying, yes, they have done bad things, but they're still my parents, and giving them that measure of respect in your mind. Because we can see the result of this equality. When taken to an extreme, the idea of equality, it ruins such systems as the teacher-student relationship and the parent and offspring relationship. It can create a great amount of stress and suffering when our parents get old and we don't want to help them. We think that they should be able to look after themselves, and we don't remember the good things that they've done, and so on. When we hold ourselves up to others, speaking back to our teachers in school, when we're yelling at our teachers, making trouble for our teachers, when all they're trying to do is help us, and so on. Then we have Isa, which is jealousy, and Machaliya, which is stinginess or miserliness. So we have people in the world who, because they don't see the benefit of giving, they see only the benefit of keeping and taking, that they are unable to appreciate when other people get good things, and they're unable to think of the benefit of giving something of theirs to other people, to others. So we often see only the benefit of the object, and we don't realize the great benefit of giving things away. And in fact, when we practice meditation, or when we start to develop ourselves, we come to really see the greater benefit of giving, the greater benefit of generosity. Like we have food, and some people who they have food, and they don't ever think that it would be good to give food to poor people, or to give alms to monks, or so on. Sometimes in Buddhist societies, they look down on monks, some people, and don't think that it would be ever be a good thing to give the food away. They look at the food as something that they've worked hard to gain, and that they are going to therefore gain pleasure from. Not realizing that there's a much greater benefit and greater happiness that comes from giving, from sharing, from giving up. And there's a great happiness which comes from appreciating what other people have. We have this great jealousy of people when they have good things, they have nice and fine things, or even good attainments, or they get a reward or an honor. We never know how to respond to this. It's kind of like a confusion or delusion in our mind. When someone gets a good thing, we don't think about it. It just rises up that I want that. And this is totally an inaccurate assessment of the situation. When someone gets something good, we should be happy for them. An accurate assessment and a good response to the situation is to appreciate and to be thankful that they got something that they wanted, that they weren't deprived of good things. So when we don't understand reality, we give rise to these states as well. This is where they come from not seeing things as they are, not seeing things the way they should be. Then we have Maya, which is illusion or deceit, and Satya, which is bragging and boasting. So trying to pretend that we're something we're not, when we have anger or greed or so on. This is even meditators are generally guilty of this. We want to pretend, and you see it even more so with meditation teachers, we want to pretend that we don't have any greed or anger and make ourselves look like we are some great and holy person and so on, trying to deceive people. It's kind of funny because most of the time you can't deceive people and you only end up looking foolish when you pretend that you are holy or enlightened and try to make people think that by the sound of your voice that somehow you have this wisdom when you talk very slowly and with this profound pausing voice and so on. You see this often in religious circles where people can be quite pretentious. But you see it even more so, I think, in the world, in worldly life. We pretend to be so many different things, and this is why we sort of get the feeling that everybody else is having a wonderful time except us. We always think that everybody else is just so happy. And we look at these stars on the big screen and we think, wow, they're so happy. They lead such wonderful lives, these movie stars. And then we hear about how they overdose on this or that drug, or they, committed to psychiatric care or so on. And what we slowly come to realize that really everyone is like this. The world is just full of suffering. Most people are just like us. They pretend. They come to us, and so these people who give all these arguments against meditation, saying, "Well, life's pretty good," and then they go home and they're crying or yelling or angry or this or that. And they go back to their jobs, which are meaningless and so on. Next, we have tampa, which is sort of being headstrong or stubborn. Not relenting or giving up. Not giving in when you are wrong, for instance, or holding on to views stubbornly or holding on to your positions stubbornly, even when you realize that you are wrong or so. Inability to change your ways. When people say, "I'm just this way, this is just how I am," and so on. And sarambha, which is similar, it's the need to be victorious all the time, the need to win in everything. When we have these arguments, and you always have to win. You've always got to win the argument, always got to have the last word, for instance. Then we have conceit, and we have two kinds of conceit. One is holding yourself up, comparing yourself to someone else as being either equal or lesser than them, and the other one is holding yourself up as higher than someone else. So even holding yourself as lower than someone is considered to be. See, it's this comparison that we were talking about earlier here. These mana and atimana, these are two similar states where we comparing ourselves to other people. We're saying, "I'm better than him," or "I'm not as good as them," feeling ourselves this kind of low self-esteem. Self-esteem in Buddhism is not a good thing. We should have no self-esteem whatsoever. We should never esteem ourselves or other people. We should just simply see things as they are. And it's clear that all of these come from not seeing things as they are, not seeing that in reality everything's just arising and ceasing. And number 15 is maddha, which is this sort of drunken state or confusion. And this is the state that sort of covers everything else over. And the 16 is pamada. These two go together as well. Maddha and pamada. One is drunkenness, one is this negligence, we always translate it as, or carelessness, heedlessness. Heedlessness in the things we do, heedlessness in the things we say, and drunkenness in our actions. We act like drunk people, acting and speaking just according to our defilements. And so it's all of these things which are at work when people make these kind of accusations about meditation. And it's these things that we don't see and we don't realize are at work in our daily lives that cause us, our inability to see these things causes us to say that everything's fine, that we're really doing okay. Really, the average ordinary person's life is full of these 16 upakilesa, these sort of 16 detailed, this detailed list of mental defilements that we grapple with on a daily basis. And most of us are deeply immersed in it. And as a result, we're giving rise to all sorts of suffering. So when people say there's no reason for me to practice meditation, they're missing all of this. They're looking at themselves and they're saying, I'm a pretty good person, and so I don't need to do anything about it. And for most of us, you could say it's probably true that we've worked hard to get to a sort of level where we can maintain ourselves in the world, you know, causing some hurt for other people, but maybe not great hurt for them. And so it's not extreme enough for us to see the problem with the problems that are existing in our minds. It's only when we practice meditation that we're able to see these. We're able to see how our mind is working. And we're able to go into detail. So I guess one answer as to the question of why people should practice meditation, or how to answer this idea that, you know, nothing's wrong, I shouldn't practice this. But if you're fine with this sort of mediocre state where we're still doing, saying, and thinking bad things and causing suffering for other people, then no, there is no reason to practice meditation. It seems that the people who really take up meditation and take it seriously, they don't have to be people who have suffered a lot, but they have to be people who are sensitive and who have a real, more detailed understanding of reality and how it works. So some people are fine with being conceited, being jealous, being stingy. Some people are fine with this, maybe. At least they say they are. I should think that when they look back on it, they do feel guilty still, if they have any conscience whatsoever. But I think most people try to forget and try to put this conscience away and not think about it, and only think about the good side of their personality and rationalizing away their bad qualities and not thinking about them, not thinking that they should do something about these, or maybe even not knowing that something can be done. And if they were to only look at these and you know, examine themselves, they should have to admit that, well, no, I don't want to be a conceited person, I don't want to be an angry person, I don't want to hate others, I don't want to be jealous or stingy, I don't want to be deceptive, I don't want to be hard-headed, I don't want to be stubborn, and so on. I don't want to be confused and drunk and not understand things the way they are. And so this is why we practice meditation. Most people don't ever come to this. Maybe the question isn't put to them, or no one ever explains it to them well. But I think there are some people out there who just don't want to see. They don't want to answer these questions. And when backed into a corner, they'll say something like, well, that's just part of being human. Without these things, I wouldn't be human, or you can't change that, or so on. And the truth is that actually, yes, you can change all of these things. You can purify your mind, and that's the practice of meditation. Simply because all of these things are a perversion of reality. We don't have to become good people. We don't have to train ourselves saying, I'm going to become good, I'm going to do good, I'm going to only think good thoughts, only say good words, only do good things, do good actions. We only have to come to understand reality, and we'll come to see that all of these things are truly immoral, and these things are a cause for suffering and a cause for stress and a cause for regret and guilt. They're not going to bring us any good consequence. They're not going to have any good result. All we have to do is come to see reality and we'll become good people. Goodness will come by itself. This is goodness. Goodness and reality are synonymous. An understanding of reality brings goodness. When you act in line with reality, wanting to be happy and therefore doing things that bring happiness, not wanting to be happy and therefore doing things that bring suffering. We want things, we want this and that, and we say that's going to bring me happiness, and we find that the more and more we want, the more and more suffering we get. So this ridiculous idea that we can somehow just chase after our desires our whole life, and when we die there's nothing, is ridiculous from the get-go, because there is no happiness in chasing after sensual pleasures, in chasing after our desires, getting the things we want. The more we chase after them, the less and less pleasurable they become, and the more and more angry and upset we get when things are otherwise than we expect, because our expectations are so high and so entrenched in our psyche. So this is, I hope this could be considered a talk about meditation. I didn't get into actual meditation practice, but it sort of gives an overview of what we're trying to improve upon in the meditation practice. In the practice, it's really quite a simple thing to practice meditation. We're just looking at reality. We're coming to try to see the reality as it is, and hopefully straighten our mind out in regards to the reality. You know, when we see things, we don't just see it, we like it or we dislike it. So meditation is coming to get away from that, and when we see, we're just seeing. When we hear, we're just hearing. When we smell, we're just smelling. When we taste, we're just tasting. So we use this tool of reminding ourselves, which is what we call mindfulness, but it really means reminding oneself or remembering things as they are. Because all of the bad things that we give rise to in our lives are simply because we don't remember, we forget things. We forget things as they are. We forget that, oh, it's just sound, or oh, it's just light touching our eye, or so on. We're so far away from the reality of the situation. That's why we give rise to all of these unwholesome things. As we practice, it's not true that we're just watching, you know, like in a stupor, or watching as an observer. We're actually actively trying to change our minds and create this clear state of mind, trying to straighten our minds out. So when we say to ourselves, for instance, seeing, remind ourselves, seeing, as we see something that might bring us great lust or great anger, or we hear something that might make us really upset or make us become attached to it. When we say to ourselves, seeing, or hearing, or when we have pain in our bodies and we say to ourselves, pain, people who are sick or dying, and when they focus on the pain and just say to themselves, pain, we come to realize and remember that it's, oh, it's just pain. And we lose this sense of, oh, it's bad, oh, it's terrible, oh, I have to do something about it, I have to get rid of it. We lose that, and that because that has nothing to do with reality. There's no should or shouldn't in reality. There's no, oh, it should be otherwise than it is. Reality simply is the way it is, and there's no reason why it should be anything else. The should and the shouldn't is totally separate from the reality of the situation. And so it's really a simple thing to practice meditation. It's simple, but not easy. Certainly not easy, but it's very simple. There's not so much to it. But it's so difficult that it actually takes a teacher. I mean, most of the time I don't like to go into too much detail about the practice, because I like to have a chance to talk to people one-on-one and give them direct advice about their practice. It's so difficult, not because there's anything particularly difficult about the concept, but simply because our mind is so bent out of shape that we can't get it. We can't see it. And we can say to ourselves, yes, yes, it's only seeing, yes, yes, it's only hearing, yes, yes, it's only pain. But our mind won't accept that, and we forget it moment to moment to moment. Where one moment we remember, we say, oh yeah, it's just pain, and the next moment we're crying, screaming about some other pain. So it either takes a teacher, or it takes great resolve and dedication. It takes usually someone to show us the way. So for anyone who thinks they can find the way without a teacher, I'd highly recommend them to think again and to take the time to find someone, anyone really, who can show you the way, who is at least even qualified. It's much easier to teach than to practice. So it's not that important that you find a perfect teacher. It's just important that you understand the Buddha's teaching and you find someone else who understands the Buddha's teaching. It's much harder for us to practice by ourselves. Just take someone as our teacher and practice and look, and you'll come to see things clearer than you did before. And hopefully be able to do away with a lot of these bad things that exist inside. And that's why we're practicing meditation. For many people, it might not seem desirable. They're not really interested in these things. But for most of the rest of us, this is something that is of great interest. The bad things which exist inside of us are of great interest, and hopefully one day we can be free from them. And that's why we practice meditation. So that's, I think, enough for today. That'll be all for the talk. If anyone has any questions, you're welcome to text them in, either on the website or in the Buddhaverse. So thanks for coming out, and hope to see you all next time.